Shalom and welcome to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. This is a recording of a Shabbat learning session with TBA rabbinic intern Ben Siegel.
While people are getting situated, I'm going to introduce how I ended up on this topic. So as I mentioned earlier, normally we read Tazria alongside Mitzorah. There's a little bit more to talk about. I'm teaching Torah quite a few times this week, and there's only so many times that I can talk about the actual Torah portion. But I wanted it to be timely and relevant, and I already taught about Pesach this past week. So I want to take a look at the Haftarah, because one of the things that stood out to me as I was looking at the Haftarah is that where it starts and where it ends seem to be completely unrelated. And hopefully through the conversation and learning we're about to do, we'll see how these two ideas of the Haftarah are related. And for what it's worth, they're from two separate chapters, so I'm not the only one who thought that they were unrelated. So for the sake of those on Zoom, I'm going to actually read through the text, but then please share your thoughts when that time comes. I do have to just say for my own
sanity. Ben?
Yes?
As the representative on Zoom, you don't have to do it for me. It got sent out as a source sheet, and I have it.
I know, but it also gets sent out as a recording. So.
Oh, sorry.
No, all good. I appreciate it. I do want to just mention for my own sake and for the sake of those here, yes, there is an echo. You're not, yeah, something along those lines. A man came from Baal Shalisha, and he brought the agent of God some bread of the first reaping, 20 loaves of barley bread, and some fresh grain in his sack. And Elisha said, "Give it to the people and let them eat." His attendant replied, "How can I set this before 100 people?" But he said, "Give it to the people and let them eat. For thus said God, they shall eat and have some left over." So he set it before them, and when they had eaten, they had some left over as God had said. So that's the end of that chapter 4.
Sounds very Christian.
Sounds very Christian. How so?
That's the whole story about Jesus multiplying the loaves for everyone to be able to eat.
They had to get it from somewhere, though, right? No, but on a serious note, Christianity is an outgrowth of Judaism. A lot of the themes and stories from Christianity come from stories that are within our own tradition. So this is the first half. We have this miracle where the bread is seemingly not enough for them to eat, and somehow it is. Hold that thought, because we're going to go in a completely different direction now. Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Aram, was an important man to his lord and high in his favor, for through him God had granted victory to Aram. But the man, though a great warrior, was a leper. Once, when the Arameans were out raiding, they carried off a young girl from the land of Israel, and she became an attendant to Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "I wish master could come before the prophet in Samaria. He would cure him of his leprosy." Naaman went and told his lord just what the girl from the land of Israel had said. And the king of Aram said, "Go to the king of Israel, and I will send along a letter." He set out, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothing. He brought the letter to the king of Israel. It read, "Now when this letter reaches you, know that I have sent my courtier Naaman to you, that you may cure him of his leprosy." When the king of Israel read the letter, he rent his clothes and cried, "Am I God to deal death or give life, that this fellow writes to me to cure a man of leprosy? Just see for yourself that he is seeking a pretext against me." Right, so just to summarize as we're going through here, Naaman is this general, essentially. He has leprosy. He finds out that there's this healer in the land of Israel who might be able to heal him of his leprosy, goes to the king who, on whose behalf he's leading an army, and says, "Can I go to Israel and get my leprosy cured?" And the king says, "Sure," and sends him along the way to the king of Israel, who says, "Oh, crap. He's trying to start a war with me on the pretext that I'm supposed to cure this, his general of leprosy. What the heck am I supposed to do here? I can't do this. So that's where we're at right now. When Elisha, the agent of God, heard that the king of Israel had rent his clothes, he sent a message to the king. Why have you rent your clothes? Let him come to me, and he will learn that there is a prophet in Israel. So Naaman came with his horses and chariots and halted at the door of Elisha's house. Elisha sent a messenger to him. Go and bathe 7 times in the Jordan, and your flesh shall be restored, and you shall be pure. But Naaman was angered and walked away. I thought, he said, he would surely come out to me and would stand and invoke the Eternal, his God, by name, and would wave his hand toward the spot and cure the affected part. Are not the Ammonah and the Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? I could bathe in them and be pure. And he stalked off in a rage. So he's come to Elisha, and Elisha says to him, doesn't even say directly to him, just says via a messenger, go and bathe in the Jordan. And Naaman is sitting here wondering, wait a minute, I came to a prophet to find out that all I had to do was like go to the mikvah, essentially. Like, what's going on here? We have rivers back home that I could bathe in. What's so special about this? He's doubting Elisha, doubting Elisha's cure for all of this, and frustrated that he's traveled all this way to get an answer that he feels like he could have done at home. But his servant came forward and spoke to him. Sir, they said, if the prophet told you to do something difficult, how would you not do it? How much more so when he has only said to you, bathe and be pure? So he went down and immersed himself in the Jordan 7 times, as the agent of God had bidden, and his flesh became like a little boy's, and he was pure. So it turns out Elisha knew what he was talking about. Returning with his entire retinue to the agent of God, he stood before him and exclaimed, now I know that there is no God in the whole world except in Israel. So please accept a gift from your servant. But he, Elisha, replied, as God lives, whom I serve, I will not accept anything. He pressed him to accept, but he refused. And Naaman said, then at least let your servant be given 2 mule loads of earth, for your servant will never again offer up burnt offering or sacrifice to any god except God. But may God pardon your servant for this. When my master enters the temple of Rimmon to bow low and worship there, and he is leaning on my arm so that I must bow low in the temple of Rimmon, when I bow low in the temple of Rimmon, may God pardon your servant in this. And he said to him, Elisha says to Naaman, go in peace, when he had gone some distance from him. And that's where it ends. Cliffhanger. Right, we have these two stories that both have to do with Elisha, but there's got to be more to what's going on here as to how these two stories get pushed together in one Haftarah. They could have just left it with the story of Naaman, which is directly related to the laws that we start to get in Tezria about Sarai. That's very clear. There's still like this question, though, of what's going on at the beginning. But before we move on, do people have other questions or thoughts that they want to share? Or things that you want clarified? I was trying to do it as we went along, but I know that it's kind of an odd story to go from one to the other. So one of the things that stood out to me as I was going through it is I looked at this in the Eitz Chaim Chumash, which always has a very nice introduction to the Haftarah. They link it. But I wanted to add a little bit of that introduction here and start a larger conversation from it. In the sparse narrative about the loaves of bread, the connecting thread is provided by the verb to give, the connecting thread throughout this entire story, Natan. A man brings his votary gift to Elisha, who instructs his steward, Gehazi, to give 10 to the people. When the steward doubts how he could give eten, the small amount of loaves, to so many people, the prophet reissues his command, give 10, the food to the people. When the steward complied and gave vayiten, the food to the masses, there was more than enough to go around. The miracle is underscored as something promised and fulfilled by God. The text also indicates Elisha's magnanimity, dispensing to the people gifts he refused to take for himself. The account of Naaman's miraculous cure is presented with greater detail and fuller dialogues. Indeed, the dialogues generate the stages of narrative action. The Israelite girl intervenes with her mistress. The Aramean commander begs leave of his king. The king of Israel misinterprets the letter of the king of Aram, and Elisha expresses readiness to perform the desired cure that Naaman might know the power of prophets in Israel. Finally, Elisha sends a message to Naaman with instructions for a cure, and Naaman presents Elisha with a theological statement recognizing the unique power of the God of Israel, whom he now wants to worship exclusively. When the Aramean commander expresses his gratitude for being cured by Elisha's gift, the man of God once again demonstrates his refusal to profit from his prophetic powers. This leads to a poignant reversal, as Naaman then requests the gift of some loads of holy earth to build a shrine to God in Aram. A shrine. That was my typing. I take full responsibility.
Just a bad hobbit.
Exactly. Puns are in general. So there's a theme here that the introduction is getting at that I want to tease out a little bit more. Well, what's going on in the first half and what's going on in the second half that links them together is miracles. Exactly. Yeah, we have this miracle of bread lasting longer. We have this miracle of water. But what I think the rabbis are trying to do in linking these two ideas together are they're two very different miracles. What's happening in this first miracle? How would you explain it, describe it?
Somehow everybody's satisfied with the amount of bread.
Everyone's satisfied with the amount of bread.
And the second one, at first Elisha refused,
So the first time around, there's like this certainty about how to do it. The second time around, there seems a little bit more uncertainty about it. How else might you describe these two different types of miracles?
The first one is a miracle for the masses. It involves the entire people getting them enough food. Mm-hmm. The second one deals solely with the problem of one person.
Yeah, that's also great. You have this, the original miracle is a miracle, or the first miracle is the miracle for masses, right? Everyone gets satisfied. The second one, I mean, you can maybe tease out if you really want to a miracle for the masses in that it doesn't then start a war, but it's really a miracle for one person. Naaman is cured of his leprosy. It could have led to bigger issues for the greater people, but it's really just a miracle for one person. But I think there's also something a little, there's one other thread between the, or one other difference between the two that I think we all can bring into our own lives. The first miracle is like truly miraculous. Everyone understands it. And it feels like something that is a miracle of miracles. And the second time around, the cure, like what actually initiates the miracle, and I guess you can even say the first time around too, is something very mundane, right? Go and bathe in the river and do it seven times. There's this intent that needs to be done. But at the end of the day, it's something that we all back in the day would have done on a semi-regular basis. Go and bathe in a river. Same thing with the food at the beginning. Eat, right? There's nothing that miraculous that initiates this miracle. Just eat and there will be enough food and you don't need to worry about it beyond there. And I wanted to bring this text and because as I was going through it, it really struck me that oftentimes when we talk about miracles in our day and age, we talk about things that we expect to have grand starts and grand finishes, right? Maybe we can all agree that bread lasting that much for 12 people is a miracle of miracles. Illness going away that seemingly can't be cured is a miracle of miracles. And we expect that there's going to be some miraculous start to it. And oftentimes it's not anything like that. It's just people going about their daily lives. Heschel was a very big fan of looking for the miracle. Abraham Joshua Heschel was a very big fan of looking for the miracles in our own life and living in radical amazement. And that is what is at the core of living a religious life, is being constantly amazed by the miracles that are going on in our lives and not taking any of them for granted. In the same way, quite opposite to Hannah Aman, takes for granted that his leprosy couldn't possibly be cured by doing something so mundane. And so one of the takeaways that I want to leave us with, there's time for discussion about it too, but is to go about our lives looking for the miracles in our lives, because they're out there. They're little things, they're huge things. They're, I can think of like five miracles that occurred to me on the way here if I really, really think about it, but I wasn't thinking about it on my way here. You know, the sun stayed up for the entire time. There wasn't an eclipse yet, so there was sun the entire way. There were paved roads for me to walk on because people had planned ahead for that. The weather was nice, it didn't rain. And yet there is plenty of rain here in Southern California, so that there's beautiful plants growing outside, right? There are all these things that we can take for granted that are in their own way miraculous if only we allow ourselves to sit in the miracle of it. I think that's a wonderful definition, that miracles are removing obstacles from our way that seemingly can't be removed, whatever they may be. A mindset, a physical barrier, whatever it could be. Yeah. Other thoughts that people wanted to share? Yeah.
I think it's very nice that Alicia didn't accept all those beautiful gifts.
Yeah, that's another really nice highlight, that Alicia didn't accept the gifts, that when we're agents of miracles in some way, and we all have the ability to be agents of miracles, that we're not taking advantage of that position for our own benefit, because the only way that we should be benefiting from being agents of miracles is that we get to live in a better world. The idea was shared that Moses, when he saw the burning bush, had to turn to see it. And that's a miracle in and of itself, that he turned when everyone else isn't turning to see this bush, how many other people pass by. I think it also highlights the idea that at the same point that we need to be in a mindset of looking for miracles, it's also not realistic for us to constantly be in that mindset, right? If we're constantly in the state that I refer to, a state of radical amazement, nothing gets done, right? All you have to do, like the best example of individuals who experience radical amazement are like 2 to 3 year olds. Walk down the street with them and you'll see that they pick up on everything. Everything is miraculous to them. You'll also see that it takes them twice as long as it needs to get from the end of one block to another. So there is always this balance that we have to live between being in a state of radical amazement, looking for the miracles in our life, and realizing that we just can't constantly live life in that way, but trying to at least be intentional of including that in our life, like Moses did.
I have a question just about the Haftarah itself.
I
can't understand why it's starting with chapter 40, whatever it is.
Chapter 4?
Chapter 4. Ella just started the Torah, and I read the second and third Aliyot. And only the first two Aliyot have to do with menstrual impurity.
Yeah.
And then it suddenly goes into a situation about skin blanching, which really ties here to this Sora.
Right.
So I couldn't figure out why in the Haftarah itself, why is it, and this is talking about the first section here, we're starting with verse 42. I couldn't understand why, and I wonder if you found any source as to why it's starting there.
Yeah, so that was the question I began with as well.
Yeah.
I don't know, like, I can't know for certain what the rabbis were thinking when they started it there. I can only give my own thesis. I went looking. There's not a ton of stuff. I didn't spend hours looking for it, I should say that, but I spent like half an hour, 45 minutes going through sources trying to find some explanation. I couldn't find one.
So maybe the two examples of miraculous events.
Yeah, I think that's the common thread, is ultimately, to get back to your question, Marshall, you have comparing and contrasting different miracles and what's going on with them, the situations in which they're occurring, the fairness or unfairness that leads to the miracle happening, whether or not the situation is made fair at the end for everyone or not. I think ultimately what the rabbis are trying to do with this Haftarah is, out of something that seems really, like, we don't live in a world where where anyone in our life is regularly experiencing Tzara'at, which I have a hard time actually translating as leprosy, because it's something different. It's something that we may understand as being physically similar, but the way that Torah and rabbis understand it, it's not a physical illness, it's a spiritual one of some sort. And so what the rabbis are doing is they're taking Tzara'at, which can seem like this thing that certainly isn't going to happen to everyone, and they're pulling out of it a narrative that everyone can relate to in the Haftarah, of talking about miracles, talking about fairness, talking about how we go about our lives in the world and how we interact with others. And I think that's something really powerful to take with us into the next week, that we can all be a little bit more aware of the miracles in our life. We can all be a little bit more aware of how fairness is involved in our life and how unfairness is involved in our life, and also how we interact with people as a result of all of that.
Is this not for us specifically for Tazria?
I believe it's just for Tazria, yeah. It's not, so all the more so, it's miraculous that we get to read this, because it isn't a regular occurrence. Where Tazria Mitzorah, I think, is, and I'm looking at Rabbi Chorny to see, is like one of the least regular, or is the most regular double parsha that we read together, right? Like, we almost never read it apart. It certainly takes years in which we're in a leap year, and then even then I don't think it always happens. So we should take advantage of this opportunity to be awoken to miracles in a time other than Hanukkah and other than all the other holidays that we have that reference miracles. Because even though we're going into Pesach, I feel like the narrative that we stick with often is freedom, and we don't spend enough time talking about all the miracles that happen for that freedom to take place.
You have been listening to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. If you enjoy these podcasts, we invite you to write a review on the Apple Podcast site or wherever you get your podcasts. For more information about Temple Beth Am Los Angeles, go to tbala.org.